Our next case is 14-1555, in re the application of Joseph Victor Libretti Jr. For the applicant, we have Mr. Martin.
May it please the court, John Martin, in my personal capacity as amicus curiae in this particular case. Your Honor, may I have 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Okay.
Thank you. I have joined with a number of my colleagues in filing an amicus brief, and I appreciate the fact that the court has given me the indulgence of not only filing a brief in this case, but of also arguing before the court. And Ms. Hoffman, Ms. Zaccaro Hoffman, who represents Mr. Libretti, has ceded the argument to me today. I've joined in an amicus brief with a number of my colleagues, including Public Defender Robert Tobik and the other members of the appellate division that I supervise at the Public Defender's Office in Cuyahoga County, all in our personal capacity, urging this court to allow Mr. Libretti the opportunity down the road to be able to reapply to take the bar. I am not asking you to allow him to take the bar today.
What's down the road?
Your Honor, at least 2 years. I don't think this court should consider, I would say to the court that the July bar in 2017 would be an appropriate time to allow Mr. Libretti to send application in contemplation of that exam. And what's going to happen in those next 2 years? We've made an investment in Joe Libretti. He wasn't brought to our attention by a reentry group or anything like that. He applied to work in our office, and we've brought him on board. And for the last year and a half, he's been there. He's in my unit now. He works 10 feet from my desk. He has done a remarkable job, and he has shown us a great deal of maturity. The maturation that's gone on in the last year and a half causes me to be confident that if you had another 2 years, you, I believe, will be favorably disposed toward his application. What I urge this court to do is to not tie its hands, not tie your own hands, and say, we cannot do that. We will not look at that. Mr. Libretti.
Counsel, if I may, I'm trying to figure out procedurally where you find yourself today then.
I've come here today in my personal capacity as an attorney, as a friend of the court. When I relate to you what's going on in the public defender's office, I'm telling you that in the sense that I work there and I can tell you what he's doing right now. But all of the attorneys in this amicus brief are before the court in our personal capacities. The public defender would not be in a position as an institution to take a position in this case.
Well, but more narrowly, my question to you is right now what's before the court is permitting him to sit for the bar, and the alternative approach is just withdraw the application altogether, correct?
And, Your Honor, Mr. Libretti has tried to withdraw his application. He filed...
Can we talk about that? I don't understand that.
He filed a motion to withdraw his application, and it was denied by the board, and instead the board felt that it was appropriate to continue the process and to urge this court to forever bar Mr. Libretti from being able to take the bar. I would submit to the court that Mr. Libretti realizes that he's not ready yet. He's shown that by virtue of the fact that he has withdrawn his application. That self-awareness, that introspection, okay, and it's not just been in withdrawing an application, because it's easy to say, well, he saw the handwriting on the wall. But it's more than that. It's the manner in which he's done it, the fact that he has acknowledged and that his responses to the panel, that his activity, both going back to pre-incarceration and post, has not put him in a position where today he is a suitable candidate for the bar.
Now, Mr. Martin,
please.
How old is he now?
51 years old.
And he served 16 of a 20-year sentence, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, actually, yes, that's correct. With federal good time, federal good time is the reason why it's a little less than 20.
And then his law school work was done prior to his incarceration?
No, Your Honor, since his incarceration.
Since the incarceration.
Since his incarceration. Since he left law school, he entered Cleveland Marshall School of Law, and you have another amicus brief from a number of professors there,
right,
and is, I believe, second in his class at this time. He was first in his class at one point, I believe, in the course of this litigation. But he's extremely bright. He is extremely hardworking. I've seen that work. My colleagues have seen that work. But I also know that being smart and being hardworking does not mean that you have the moral fiber to practice law.
Counsel, what do you think the objection, the base of the objection is to allow him to obtain a license to practice law?
I believe that the board has concluded, and I understand where the board's coming from, that there has been persistent lack of regard for doing the right thing. Not just being on one, whether or not you bring your toe up to the line of legal or not, but doing the right thing, of being a morally responsible human being. I think that that, in the end, would be the umbrella over which I would put all of the other things that the board has
seen.
And
that is based on past and not so recent past conduct, correct?
Is correct, Your Honor.
As recent as 2010, 2012?
2010, 2011, Your Honor. That is correct.
All right. So what I see it as being that, yeah, he's doing well in law school, and he's surrounded by good, solid, ethical attorneys.
Thank you.
And he's able to function under that, in that arena. But what would it be like with someone who has demonstrated his lack of regard for the rule of law, if he's unleashed without your watchful eye, and he has a license to practice law, is it just a matter of time before we have a string of complaints by clients, maybe indictments by the state, and we're here for disbarment? And in it is a wake of disastrous outcomes for clients and the public.
I do not believe so. In having seen him in our office for the past year and a half, and I think that an even further track record would be established before he would be coming back before this court. But here's why I don't think so. Number one, his zeal and dedication to his clients has been both unqualified and he does not spare anything when it comes. There are no hesitation when it comes to working hard for a client. At the same time, it has been ethical. Linda Ricco from our office at 241 of the record, and it's mentioned in our brief, talks about how when Mr. Libretti had his license to practice as a legal intern, that his dealings with the prosecutor were done in a very open manner that she mentioned in one particular case. So clients are not going to come back and say, he did not work hard on my case. That's number one. Number two, while Mr. Libretti is not a thief. Mr. Libretti is not someone who has taken money from he doesn't have a record that would say he's going to take money from an IOLTA account or something like that. One of the big concerns that this court frequently has to deal with and the like. In the end, Mr. Libretti is somebody who has, part of his problem has been his communication with the board, too. And I'm not trying to downplay anything that he's done, okay? But part of what has happened, too, is that one of the reasons why the board is upset about this case, and I understand why, is they don't feel that he has been candid with them. One of the things that we've tried to explain, both in our brief and in some of the other amicus briefs, is the fact that the defensive nature that you take on when you've been in prison for that long, the guard that you put up is such that you become very defensive, you become very literal. We've seen
Counsel, you can characterize it that way if you'd like, but he came out of prison after 16 years. He engaged in what I would consider a questionable pattern of business dealings in Wyoming. And when asked about that when he was applying to practice law in Ohio, he concealed all those facts, did he not?
Your Honor, he discussed those facts with the county panel, the original interview. He talked about those facts. He did not put them forward in the application. And one of the things here is this. This is the kind of thing where he got hyper-technical and he got legalistic. And he knows now that, you know, you don't do that. And quite frankly, you know, because what he was saying was, well, is it technically legal or illegal? Who cares whether it's technically illegal or illegal? Spice is not a good thing. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it is, nor would Mr. Libretti tell you that it is today. He's acknowledged the fact that he should have been more forthcoming. But
there was a recruiting a known meth dealer to be part of this operation, and there was a ton of money involved, and none of that came to account when he was still on supervision from the federal court, right?
Well, and Your Honor, you know, I really don't want to parse facts, and I'm going to answer your question, but at the same time, we'll start with that. In terms of his relationship with Breeden, his probation officer, you know, they were both in the same halfway house. So the notion that they were seeing each other, that they were in the same place, was not a secret to anyone, including his probation officer. I would point out that he was never violated for supervised release, even though there's a lesser standard of proof with respect to a supervised release violation. He was never violated on supervised release during the tenure of his supervised release, and he successfully completed it. That having been said, the Joe Libretti that I've seen in the last year would not answer those questions in that way. And the Joe Libretti, you know, go back to the chief's question, how do you know? Candidly, you don't yet, which is why you should not be approving his application. I think Joe Libretti's turned the corner. But with his past, it's not enough to turn the corner. You have to stay on the straight and narrow and show that you're going to be ethical and you're going to be responsible. What I'm suggesting to the court is don't tie your hands from allowing him to demonstrate that. He can do a lot of good. He has done a lot of good in my office already. I don't believe that his career plans are going to change. I don't think he's going to want to go into the private practice of law. I think he wants to be a public defender for the rest of his life. And quite frankly, I would love the opportunity to be able to hire him as an attorney.
So your advocacy today is that we do nothing for 2 years?
My advocacy today is that you would either allow him to withdraw this application or deny this application, but with leave to be able to file again no sooner than 2 years, so that there would be a period of time where he is going to have to demonstrate his good conduct, that he is going to have to show that he has that moral fiber to practice law. I think he has it. I think he has it today, but I know Joe Libretti in a different way than the board does, in a different way than you do. And I'm willing to put that to the test to see whether or not I'm right, and whether or not Bob Tobik is right, whether or not Jeff Gamzo is right, whether or not Colin Sweeney is right. Names I mention to you because these are attorneys that you know, and attorneys who have appeared before you, or in some cases with you as co-counsel, during the course of your legal careers.
Now, so how did he happen to come to Cleveland? Why are we so lucky?
Well, you know, Your Honor, it was a reversal of the brain drain. Your Honor, I believe that the reason why Mr. Libretti came to Cleveland was that when he applied to law school, Cleveland Marshall looked upon him and said, we're willing to take a chance.
Was it the only law school that would take him?
I don't know if it was the only one, but I know it was one that did. And so, and my understanding is that, he had applied to law school, and Cleveland Marshall, you know, took a chance. But, you know, Cleveland Marshall took a chance, and now you have professors from Cleveland Marshall saying, we think there will be a day when he can practice law in this state. My office took a chance, and we're saying to you the same thing. What I'm suggesting to you is give yourselves the opportunity to take that chance down the road, not to take a chance in a risky venture, but to decide whether or not this is a sound investment. And you can, yes, Your Honor.
I was going to say it's almost as if he were a practicing attorney now, what you're arguing is for an indefinite suspension as opposed to a disbarment. I mean, that seems to be the analogy that we're going to have to consider.
Yes,
would you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be the analogy that I would consider. And I would submit to the court that if you look at previous cases that you've had with attorneys who have had felony records, that this would not be a permanent disbarment case. And so for that, and I realize that once again I've gone over time, and I apologize to the court for that. If there are no further questions.
Well, I do have a question. Is your client, does he have a history of addiction? Is he in OLAP now? Is he in treatment? What's the story there?
Your Honor, he is not in OLAP now. He does not have a history of addiction. But I appreciate the question because it was something that I meant to mention to you. Because this court has looked in the past at whether or not there's a light at the tunnel when it comes to psychiatric or psychological rehabilitation and the like. For the last 2 years or so, Mr. Libretti has been treated for post-traumatic stress disorder. And I believe that cycle of treatment has just recently completed. And I believe that the source of the PTSD was the period of imprisonment. And so, accordingly, what you have is then that adds to that prison angst and ability to communicate that was talked about in some of the other amicus briefs and alluded to in our brief as well. So there has been PTSD. And if this court were to impose as a condition during the court, as a prerequisite to any further application by Mr. Libretti, that he receive further counseling or show evidence of further counseling at the time of the application, I think that would be entirely appropriate in a situation such as this.
All right, one other question.
Please.
In the reply brief, I'm looking at a scenario that happened in March of 2011. He was indicted in Wyoming.
Yes.
For a single count of conspiracy to distribute meth.
Yes.
His apartment was searched in Cleveland.
Yes.
And he sought immunity as a result of that, and he was granted immunity from prosecution. Explain that to me.
Among his personal belongings was some of the spice precursor chemicals, which had become illegal in March of 2011.
But he had possession of them prior to March.
Yes, when they were still, technically they were still legal. Doesn't mean they were moral, but they were legal. And he had bundled them up in a package addressed to his attorney that was going to be sent out, because he was trying to figure out how he's supposed to get rid of this illegal substance.
How much was it?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know the quantity. It was one package, okay?
And the trash wouldn't have worked.
Well, Your Honor, I suppose if you dispose of an illegal substance in that manner, I'm not sure that that couldn't be interpreted by the state of Ohio as tampering with evidence, obstructing justice, and the like. Going through the attorney was not, I would submit to the court, a completely irresponsible manner in which to deal with this. Now, that having been said, the attorney was seeking and made overtures to the U.S. Attorney's mm-hmm. Office with respect to the issue of immunity, if you will, almost a production-type immunity, and with subsequent testimony about that package. One of the things that gets caught up in all this stuff is there's this back and forth, was it immunity, wasn't it immunity? And I think I can speak to that a little bit from my past background. When you seek immunity under Title 18 United States Code, Section 6001, it doesn't begin and end as far as I, and certainly the way it was when I practiced, and I believe it's still the same. It can't begin and end in a U.S. attorney's office. A U.S. attorney can authorize an application, but eventually you have to go back to Washington, D.C. It goes through the criminal division, the Office of Enforcement Operations, whatever, and there has to go through to get formal use immunity under the U.S. code. That process was never done. That having been said, U.S. attorneys' offices have, for years, and there's nothing wrong with this, had informal letter immunity type arrangements whereby the immunity was being given by the U.S. attorney in a particular district, but it didn't have all the formal trappings. To the extent that we get caught up in that technical term immunity, we open ourselves to a certain amount of confusion as to what was going on. But there were overtures made, and it was an assistant U.S. attorney who was contacted with respect to that. And that goes to the issue of, was the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Northern District of Ohio going to go after somebody for having these chemicals when they weren't using them at that point? It's pretty clear that they were not, based on the fact that there's these overtures of immunity and there's never been a prosecution. At the same time, it was not that formal immunity. I hope that clarifies that issue. But that's why Joe or Mr. Libretti was looking for immunity in that, or his attorney. And that's the other thing, you know, his attorney doing a good job is going to do that. But Mr. Libretti was nonetheless candid about, he's made admissions about that to the extent that he does not have formal immunity from the United States government, and he may have incriminated himself. He hasn't hesitated to do it. He's talked about his spice dealings. He's talked about all of that. He has admitted to the fact that he was involved in that activity. If there are no further questions, the court's been very indulgent, and I thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Crist.
Madam Chief Justice, if it pleases the court, my name is Paul Crist, and I represent the Cleveland Metropolitan Bar Association in this application. Twice, Mr. Libretti has conceded that he has failed to meet his burden of proof under governing bar the rules of the rule one of the rules of the governance of the bar of the state of Ohio. He therefore has conceded one of the two principal aspects of the report and recommendation of the panel, of the unanimous panel, which was adopted by the board and which is now before this court. Let me give you a bit and a brief bit of the factual background of this case. I think the Chief Justice was correct in saying that some of the events are relatively remote, some of them are recent, but in addition to that, some of them are very recent. My focus will be principally upon those which are very recent, but we'll start with some of the ones that were more distant in time. In 1992, Mr. Libretti was convicted of being a kingpin in a continuing criminal enterprise involving the sale of cocaine, marijuana, ecstasy, one other drug, I forgot the name of it, and something called psilocybin mushrooms in the states of Wyoming and Colorado. He was sentenced to 20 years of imprisonment, which was the minimum statutory period of imprisonment at that time. In late 2007, he was released into a halfway house in Casper, Wyoming, where he did indeed meet both his roommate, Brian Frank Holyoas, and another man by the name of William Breeden, both of whom were convicted drug dealers, felons, and one of whom became his roommate, Mr. Holyoas. Mr. Breeden did not. He began parole, federal supervised release, in May of 2008, and that continued until May of 2013, 1 month before his bar application interview, which was on June 6th, 2013. In June of 2010, his Casper residence was searched. And in the course of that search, law enforcement officers found in his possession marijuana, synthetic marijuana, also known as spice, and $7,200 that was found in a heating vent. The reason I mention that those specific details is they'll come back to us in a minute. He was then arrested on a single count of involvement with methamphetamine under a sealed indictment on March 18th of 2011. Incident to that indictment, a federal search warrant was issued out of Cleveland Federal Court and then executed on his Cleveland apartment. Spice was found along with some documentation and other materials. Following the return of that warrant, Mr. Libretti sought immunity through his appointed federal defense counsel. Mr. Martin has explained that there are very formalized types of immunity and that there are much more informal and perhaps much more common informal types of immunity. Neither of those was disclosed in his application to this court. His application was filed on November 12th of 2012. They were not disclosed in any pre-hearing supplement to his application to this court. Following that request for an informal grant of immunity, the storage locker to his apartment was searched. And there was seized a chemical that is used to make synthetic marijuana, at least one, which is called JWH-018. The JWH-018 had been scheduled as an illegal controlled substance by the DEA earlier that month. The DEA announced it was going to do so in Thanksgiving 2010 and then did so on March 1st. And Mr. Libretti still had that illegal controlled substance in his possession. That violated the terms of his parole. It also exposed him, without the grant of immunity, to potential criminal prosecution. None of those things were disclosed in Mr. Libretti's application. We'll come back in a second to what has happened since that time. Because of his felony conviction, the case now is before this court, and it was required to go before a panel of the board and the board on its way to reaching this court. This court has made it clear in In Re Poignon, which is at 132 Ohio State 3rd, 395, that where you have a prior felony conviction, the applicant must prove both that he's morally fit to practice law and that he is fully and completely rehabilitated. After the hearing, a two-day hearing in this matter before the panel on November 6th, 2013, and January 7th of 2014, the panel concluded and the board later adopted that Mr. Libretti had failed to demonstrate by clear and convincing evidence that he possesses the requisite character, fitness, and moral qualifications for admissions to this honorable profession in the state of Ohio. And secondly, it found citing his noted lack of candor that the panel recommended that Libretti not be permitted to reapply for admission to the practice of law.
And that was 2013.
That was 2014.
14. All right. The notable lack of candor about what?
The panel found that Mr. Libretti was not truthful in his application. He was not truthful, which was on November 12, 2012. He was not truthful in his June 6, 2013 interview. He was not truthful during the two-day hearing before the panel on November 6, 2013 and January 7, 2014, and that he was not truthful in a post-hearing supplement that he filed on May 6th of 2014.
And the rationale or reason that Mr. Martin has put forth is that Mr. Libretti had a hyper-technical response mechanism to looking at this, what they're asking me, and he was very, parsing what information. He was guarded as a result of his experience in prison, and thought that he was meeting the letter, if not the spirit, of the disclosure requirements.
I heard Mr. Martin say that, and I respectfully disagree with that analysis. I do, first, for a couple reasons. First, I don't think this court should adopt a lower standard of candor for those with prior felony convictions and time in jail. Secondly, the fact of the matter was that he had under his belt 5 years of parole, and he had under his belt, at the time of the hearing, basically 3 years of law school. He had, and he understood what the requirements are. He certified in his application. He understood what the requirements were. His own professor came in as a character witness and said that truth and candor are absolutely essential requirements for those that want to take the bar. He knew that well in advance.
Right.
Of the
time. And you mentioned prior to talking about the hearings that there's several things that happened in Wyoming, the search, the finding of the drugs and the money in the register, and then you went on to say about the substance that was found in a storage unit in Cleveland, et cetera. I'm presuming those are the topics. The facts that were not disclosed in these hearings and applications. Am I correct?
In the none of it was disclosed in the application.
That was in 2012.
November 12, 2012. Yeah. None of it was disclosed during the CMBA interviews on June 6th of 2013.
Right.
It did come out during the course of the hearing, although there are conflicts even there among Michelle Brady's own testimony. All these facts were first evolved during the course of the hearing before the panelists. And indeed, let me just give you one example of what I think troubled the panel. The interview with the Bar Association folks was on June 6th of 2013. The very next day, Mr. Libretti wrote each of those interviewers a letter. It is in the record. It's part of Exhibit 42, CMBA Exhibit 42. And in that, on the first page, Mr. Libretti writes, "Since my release from prison, I have not broken any laws, with the exception of two minor traffic incidents that I disclosed in my character and fitness application. I do not lie, steal, or cheat, and nothing in my background suggests otherwise." He wrote this letter knowing that he had marijuana had been seized from his Casper residence. He wrote this letter knowing that JWH-018 had been found in his Cleveland apartment storage locker. And he wrote this knowing that he had sought and been granted at least informal immunity, which was not mentioned to the interviewers. He also told the interviewers during that same June 6th, 2013 interview that he had fully complied with the terms of his federal supervisor list, his parole. And that was untrue.
Was he violated on the parole?
He was not violated on it.
And he wasn't convicted in Wyoming for the possession of the drug money or the marijuana?
A couple of questions there. He was not prosecuted for the JWH-018. It was only a single methamphetamine charge that was brought in federal court in Wyoming. He was not prosecuted there for possession of the marijuana or the possession of the spice, only for the methamphetamine. He has not been charged, and he's been granted immunity with respect to the controlled substance JWH-018 that was seized in Cleveland. But Your Honor asked an important question, if I can go just a little bit beyond it, because forfeiture proceedings were initiated in Wyoming with respect to the $7,200 that was seized out of that heating vent. And the Wyoming Supreme Court, adopting the language of the trial court, wrote, "The court further finds that plaintiffs, the state of Wyoming, has proven by a preponderance of the evidence that the funds seized from Ms. Libretti and Mr. Holyoak were proceeds from violations of the Wyoming Controlled Substances Act."
And what date was that?
This opinion, and by the way, this is Exhibit, Bar Association Exhibit 27, is dated May 30th, 2012.
So in lieu of prosecution in Wyoming, they just took the $7,200 and said, we'll call it a day.
State of Wyoming took that.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Federal government did not prosecute.
Right.
Otherwise, on the other charges. By the way, that there's still litigation pending in Wyoming that Mr. Libretti has brought pro se. So, I mean, there's still a fight even on it. Let me now go back to the question.
Is there current litigation against any of the? Pardon me. Is there current litigation in Wyoming against any of the agents or the drug enforcement agents? Is that still pending?
Well,
to your knowledge,
following his acquittal, he brought a 41G motion for compensation in Wyoming. That is now concluded. He also brought an action in the Northern District of Ohio, which he lost on summary judgment, or motion to dismiss, I think, motion to dismiss, which was appealed to the Sixth Circuit. He sought to withdraw his appeal, which was denied. The Sixth Circuit then, I believe, in January, denied his appeal. So that, the Northern District of Ohio. But then, much to our surprise, Ms. Libretti filed another case in Wyoming, a civil case in Wyoming, naming Stephen Woodson, the same defendant that he sued in Cleveland, and another fellow by the name of Taylor Courtney, or woman, perhaps. And he filed it in Wyoming using a Northern District of Ohio caption, which he corrected in his amended complaint. But he just evidently just Xeroxed it and refiled it in Wyoming. So that litigation is ongoing.
But what's that litigation for?
He has sued them, claiming that illegal searches and that they didn't return that which had been seized from him.
Which was?
The spice, both the leafy materials, the chemicals that were applied to it. I think there were some papers. I think most everything else had been returned.
What about the $7,200? Does he want
that? That was Wyoming. That's race judicata.
Okay, so that's all done with in Wyoming.
$7,200 is race judicata, and the finding of that court is, in my view, race judicata with respect to the legality of his conduct in Wyoming.
In the report that we have from the board, there's a reference to the fact that Mr. Libretti had filed multiple suits against each of the special agents in Wyoming, Green River Police Department, and he'd done that on multiple occasions, and other DEA and Colorado law enforcement agents. When were those lawsuits filed, and are they concluded, to your knowledge?
They were filed beginning after his 1992 conviction.
Oh, I see.
And they continued throughout the 90s, and at least as recently as 2003, perhaps more recently than that. But they, that's my knowledge, are now concluded.
That litigation has been concluded?
I hope so.
Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to respond to one of the points that Mr. Martin made. He talked about the fact that Mr. Reddy filed a motion before the panel and thus the board to withdraw his application. And he told this court that, I'm trying to see if I can paraphrase his words, showed that Mr. Libretti had turned a corner, that he had recognized the deficiencies in his current state of character, fitness, and moral qualifications, and that was a great encouragement. I would ask this court then to say, why, having turned the corner in his motion to withdraw to the board in 2014, does he come into this court in his opening brief and challenge the very conclusions which he there conceded? Why does he berate the panel for the way in which it conducted the hearing? Why does he conclude, as he does in that brief, telling this court that to adopt the panel's report and the board's report and recommendation would be unconscionable? Why did he tell this court that to adopt that report and recommendation would be a demonstration of hypocrisy? And yet he turns around, flip-flops once again, and in his reply concedes that he failed to meet his burden of proof, that he failed to display the level of candor expected of him by the board, and then throw himself on the mercy of the court. Let me make one final comment, if I may.
Just one.
Thank you. I really appreciate Mr. Martin and his fellow amici for coming to present their viewpoints to you. But their viewpoints, their hope for the future, is not the test for admission in Ohio. Their ability to mentor him depends upon Mr. Libretti's truthfulness with them. Mr. Libretti has been employed by them since May of 2013. Every one of the events in the bar application process where Mr. Libretti was found by the board to have been evasive, to have been deceitful, to have lied, to be less than candid, took place during the period of his employment with the Public Defender's Office. If federal supervised release doesn't do it, if his law school faculty's mentorship doesn't do it, I think we have to be very careful about assuming that Mr. Libretti will be as candid as need be when he can't before this court and he hasn't been in the past.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
Thank you. The court, please. You do need to be careful. Nobody questions that you need to be careful, which is why we're not saying let him take the bar today. But what we are saying is that the period of time that we're talking about post-conviction is going to be significantly expanded when you put this out and don't allow him to apply for a while. I would point out, and I don't want to get into tit for tat when it comes to the evidence in this case, because I'm not going to sit here and tell you that he's prepared to take the bar. But he did, I believe, mention the 2011 prosecution. I think it was listed on his bar application, and I think he told the interviewers about it too, and the record will speak for itself. He did not shy away from reporting his prior convictions. He did not shy away from reporting the fact that in 1985, before any of this stuff, he had received formal immunity. So it wasn't as if, and I think that that adds context to the fact that if he was trying to hide the fact of immunity, he wouldn't have lied about, he would have lied about that one, and he did not do that. You know, a lack of candor, as I'm not asking for a different standard because you've been to prison, that somehow you get a break. I'm not suggesting that. But a lack of candor in this court's jurisprudence has traditionally been the reason why you delay allowing somebody to apply. I'm simply saying that's the thing to do in a situation like this. And the only lawsuit that's left in this Wyoming lawsuit is really more of a follow-up collections kind of a thing of, you've already said I'm supposed to get some property back. It hasn't come back yet. And that's the only thing that's left. Mr. Libretti recognizes that, and it's something that a lot of we lose sight of sometimes in this profession, that litigation isn't necessarily the correct answer. And finally, do I wish he had written a different type of brief in his opening objections to this court in this case now? Yes. But I would suggest to you that he did this through counsel at that point. You know, sometimes we as attorneys get too aggressive. Sometimes we lose sight of things when we write our briefs, when we ask clients. I've asked for immunity for clients. That doesn't necessarily mean they did anything wrong. It means I'm doing my job and I'm trying to be an aggressive advocate. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that the person behind the attorney is saying that in his own personal capacity.
Thank you.
Give him a chance. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshal, will you please adjourn court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.